You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Her Money is proudly sponsored by Edelman Financial Engines. When life gives us a financial windfall, first comes gratitude, then comes financial planning, because being empowered with our money is everything. To learn more, visit planefe.com/hermoney and schedule your complimentary wealth checkup today.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for joining me today on Her Money. So we all know at least one person who can enter a room and strike up a conversation with just about anybody. What is it they have that we don't? The good news is not as much as you'd think. Effective communication is a skill that can be learned. In my conversation with Charles Duhigg, the best-selling author who's got a great new book out called Super Communicators, we're going to dig into three types of conversation. And this is really important. How to identify which one you're engaged in when. Plus, in Mailbag, we're going to talk about how to choose the right high-interest savings account for you and how much is too much to be paying for private insurance. So let's get into a few pieces of timely financial news this week. First up, the Federal Reserve met last Wednesday and left interest rates steady at about 5.25%, where they have been set since July 2023. The Fed continued to forecast that borrowing costs will come down somewhat by the end of the year as inflation continues to cool. What that means is that if you are on the fence about, say, beginning a home renovation or replacing your car or even taking out a loan to expand your business, you may want to wait a few months. Policymakers are trying to balance two key risks as they decide when and how much to dial back high rates. On one hand, they want to keep rates high enough long enough to ensure that inflation is fully non-problematic anymore. But they also want to avoid keeping rates elevated for too long, which could inflict unnecessary damage on the economy. Officials say inflation is moving sustainably toward their 2% target and that they expect to start cutting rates later this year. They're projecting 3 interest rate reductions, which made the markets quite happy. It triggered all 3 major U.S. stock indices to close at their highest levels ever. The markets are hoping for the first rate cut in June. Unilever will not be screaming for ice cream this summer. After 24 years, the company said they're planning to sell Ben & Jerry's as well as their other ice cream businesses. You didn't know it, but they also own Magnum and Cornetto. Look, Unilever is a massive company, best known for brands like Dove, Hellmann's, and Vaseline. The sale will end an unusual corporate partnership that began in 2000 when Unilever bought Ben & Jerry's for $326 million. At the time of that purchase, Ben & Jerry's stipulated it could have an independent board. This allowed it to continue taking openly progressive stances on social and political issues, which, to be honest, sometimes caused friction with the corporate parent. The separation comes after activist investor Nelson Peltz joined Unilever's board in 2022 to push for changes. Unilever also appointed a new CEO in 2023, and he put a strategic plan in place to revitalize the business. They made this decision in part because their profit margin on ice cream is less than half of what it makes selling all of those personal care products. In the wake of the announcement, shares went up nearly 3%. If you're interested in why stocks move the way they do, check out my investing club for women. It's called Investing Fix. We spell it with two X's. We're getting smart about stocks and making money together. Finally, the cost of storing frozen embryos is on the rise, and because of that, some families are opting to destroy theirs. In a recent article from the Washington Post, one couple said they were paying $65 per month to keep their remaining embryos stored, a cost that had been going up steadily each year by $10 to $15 per month. Their finances continued to tighten as groceries became more expensive on top of the money they were spending on childcare. So they ultimately made the decision to dispose of those embryos last summer. Because of inflation and supply chain pressures, more and more people are making tough decisions like this one to destroy or donate their genetic material to science to cut costs. We'll keep you posted on this topic going forward. Before we dive into the interview, we're going to take a quick break. Her Money is proudly sponsored by Edelman Financial Engines. We save and invest for our financial futures because we know that even though the future may be uncertain, planning is everything. Sometimes in life, we enjoy financial windfalls too. We may gain an inheritance, liquidate a business, or receive a monetary gift or a settlement. Even in these days of more mega million jackpots than ever, we may win the lottery. When this happens, we all want to make the most out of every dollar we've been given, and we can. Learn more at planefe.com/hermoney and schedule your complimentary wealth checkup today. Think about the conversations that you have every day, the ones you have with your friends over coffee to catch up on their lives, with your family members when you're walking the dog, or with your child's teacher when you want to figure out how they're actually doing in school. Now, what if I told you that every one of those conversations, even the most mundane of them, are really negotiations, and that once we have the skills to know what type of conversation we're in, we can use every single conversation in order to better connect to those people around us. That's what Charles Duhigg argues in his new book. It's called Super Communicators: How to Unlock the Secret Language of Connection. Charles, of course, has been on the show before, but it's been a little while, so let me tell you a bit about him. We've had him on in the past to talk about his mega bestseller, The Power of Habit, and also Smarter, Better, Faster, which was the follow-up to that book. He's also a Pulitzer Prize-winning staff writer at The New Yorker, and he's here to tell us today about conversations, what makes them click, and how we can all be better communicators, both in our work and in our lives. Charles, always good to see you. Congrats on the publication of this new one.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on. This is such a treat.
What took you in this direction? What was it? I kind of think I have a feel for how your brain works and how you go down a research hole and how every once in a while it becomes a book. But what was it about communication that sent you on this journey?
Well, I think it was actually a pattern that I got into with my wife. As a journalist, I'm theoretically a professional communicator, and I've been married with my wife almost 20 years now. And I would come home from work and this thing would happen that was confusing to me. I would start complaining about my day. And my wife would give me this very good advice. She would say something like, "Why don't you take your boss out to lunch and you guys can get to know each other better?" And instead of being able to hear what she was saying, I would get even more upset. And I would say, "Why aren't you supporting me? You're supposed to be on my side." And then she would get upset because I was attacking her for giving me good advice. I think this is something that probably many married couples can relate to, right? And sometimes the roles were flipped, where she would mention how she was feeling and I would try and offer a solution, which she didn't appreciate. And so I was curious why this kept happening, why it's so common. And I went to researchers and asked them, and they said, "Well, look, We know a lot about communication now because we're living through this golden age of understanding communication because of advances in neural imaging and data collection. And they said one of the big things that we've learned is that we tend to think of a discussion as being about one thing, right? We're talking about my day, or we're talking about our kids' grades, where we should go on vacation. But actually, every discussion is made up of different kinds of conversations. And in general, those conversations, they fall into one of three buckets. There's these practical conversations where we're solving problems or we're making plans together. But then there's emotional conversations where I might tell you how I'm feeling, and I don't want you to solve my feelings. I want you to empathize. And then there's finally social conversations, which is about how we relate to each other and society and the social identities that are important to us. And they said the key is, if you're not having the same kind of conversation at the same moment, you won't really hear each other. You won't really connect. And that, of course, is what was happening with my wife and myself. I was coming home and I was having an emotional conversation, and she responded with a practical conversation. And so it created more tension rather than more communication.
I'm shaking my head because I totally relate to everything that you just said. It happens in my house all the time, to the extent where sometimes I can hear myself saying to my husband, I don't want you to fix this. I just want you to listen to me.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And once your husband is on that wavelength, right, once he understands what his job is, then it gets so much better. And so actually, one of the things that started happening is that now at the beginning of conversations, Liz and I ask each other, what kind of conversation do you want to have? She might say to me, do you want me to help you solve this issue, or do you want me just to listen? Do you just need to get this off your chest? And of course, it feels really good to be asked that, because sometimes I haven't thought about it until that moment. And I can say, no, this isn't that big a deal. I just need to vent about it. In schools, they've actually taught teachers to start doing this, that when a student comes up with a problem or a question and something that they want to talk about, that the teacher should start by asking them, do you want to be helped? Do you want to be heard? Or do you want to be hugged?
Wow.
Right, which are the three kinds of conversations, the practical, the emotional, and the social. And I think when you ask that, the students really appreciate it because they know that what they're being asked is, what do you need? Like, what are you hoping to get out of this conversation? And once we're aligned on that, we're much more likely to get it.
How did you and researchers discover that there are, in fact, these three different kinds of conversations?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with these neural imaging research projects that have had occurred. What would happen is that researchers are able for the first time really to study people's brains as they have conversations with each other. And they saw this kind of interesting thing. And some of this we had known for a little while, that when you're in a good conversation with someone, when you're clicking with someone, even if it's over the telephone, your body starts to change. You begin to breathe alike. Your heart rates begin to match each other. But what scientists were able to see now was that not only does that happen, but actually the activity within our brain, the neural signals that's happening, as we're talking to someone, our brains look more and more similar. We begin thinking alike. And this makes sense when you think about it, because if I tell you about an emotion that I'm feeling or an idea that I had, you actually experience a little bit that emotion or that idea. That's why communication is effective, is because we're experiencing something together simply through describing it. But what we know is that as our brains become more and more similar, as they become, in the language of neurology, neurally entrained, we're able to hear each other much better. We're able to understand what the other person is saying. And this is actually the goal of conversation and communication, is to achieve this neural entrainment, to get on the same wavelength, if you will, because that's when we really understand each other and when we're able to connect.
When you have a person in your life and you routinely finish each other's sentences, is that what's happening?
Absolutely. It's because of that neural entrainment, because you're having the same thought at the same time. And for you, sometimes people ask, like, who is a super communicator? And I think the answer is if you were having a bad day and you wanted to call someone who you know would just make you feel better, do you know who you would call?
Sure. I mean, I would call my husband. There are people in my life that I definitely wouldn't call, people who I love, but sometimes trying to unpack something about my bad day turns into a conversation about their bad day, and that's not where I want to go.
Exactly. So your husband is for you a super communicator, and you're probably a super communicator back for him. We are all have moments of super communication. We all have those moments when we walk into a meeting and we know exactly what to say to win everyone over. Or a friend calls and we know exactly what question to ask to help them figure out what's going on and make them feel better. Now, there are some people, though, who can do this more consistently. There's some people who can connect with almost anyone. And what we've learned is that those people simply learn a series of skills. When I first started doing this reporting, I thought that super communicators were probably people who were really charismatic or extroverts, or that they were born knowing how to do this. And what I discovered is exactly the opposite. Super communicators are simply people who have learned a handful of skills and have practiced them until they become habits. And it's those skills that allow us to connect with anyone else. And they're skills that anyone can learn, whether you're an introvert or extrovert or charming or really curmudgeonly. It's like learning to read. Anyone can do it.
One of the interesting things about this work, and I want to dive into how we become those better communicators, but one of the interesting things to me, because we're a money show, is that this sort of practice gives you the ability to become more able to talk about difficult things, right? When we talk about talking about money, it's one of those things that people avoid because communicating about it can be wildly uncomfortable. But have you found that simply having this skill set enables people to talk about things they'd rather not talk about?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And let's take money as an example. Oftentimes when we have conversations about money, we treat it as if it's a practical conversation. We're talking about a budget, or we're talking about planning for next year or planning for retirement. But the truth of the matter is, oftentimes, even though we're using practical language and we're pretending this is a practical discussion, it's really an emotional conversation, right? What we're talking about is we're talking about our anxieties. We're talking about guilt because I feel like you're saying that I'm spending too much money, or I'm not being responsible enough, or I'm worried about the future, or I'm excited about the future. I'm looking forward, and it feels complicated to feel like I'm financially secure. And most conversations about money are emotional conversations. And when we acknowledge that, when we say to the other person, look, I want to talk about money and I want to talk about our budget, and there is a practical conversation here, but before we do it, we need to have the emotional conversation. We need to get on the same wavelength, because if you're practical and I'm emotional, this isn't going to work. And so let me just tell you how I'm feeling and you tell me how you're feeling. And once we're connected that way, then we can move on to these practical questions or these social questions, but we're moving together. We feel like we're in cooperation rather than in opposition. So absolutely, conversations where there's conflict, where there's uncertainty, ambiguity, anxiety, those become so much easier when we first start by saying, what kind of conversation are we having? And let's get aligned on that. Let's make sure we're having the same kind of conversation and moving through the conversations together.
So let's get tactical, not to be confused with practical, and talk about how we know which of these conversations we're in. And then I'd love to talk about the steps that we all need to learn in order to get better at it.
Yeah. And actually, they're very similar. So the first skill to develop in order to figure out what kind of conversation is happening is to get better at asking questions. And some questions are more powerful than others. One of the things that we know about super communicators is that consistent super communicators is that they tend to ask 10 to 20 times as many questions as the average person. And some of those questions are what's known as deep questions. And a deep question asks us about our values or our beliefs or experiences. And that can sound intimidating, but it's as simple as if you meet someone who's a doctor, instead of asking them, where do you practice medicine? Asking them, oh, what made you decide to become a doctor? Like, why'd you go to medical school? Or what do you love about being a doctor? Did you always want to be one from when you were a kid? Those are asking deep questions, and they don't seem deep. They don't seem intrusive, but they're giving the other person an opportunity to talk about who they are. So the first skill is ask more questions, particularly if you're upset. There's this phrase that I love that says, if you're feeling furious, get curious. Ask more questions, and particularly deep questions that invite other people to say real things. That's the first and most important skill, because inevitably they'll tell you what kind of conversation they want to have.
It's so funny listening to this because I feel like any budding journalist should also make sure that they read this because this is our playbook, right? I mean, ask a lot of questions, listen really well, and give a little to get a little.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. Which brings us to the second skill, which is asking questions on its own often isn't enough, particularly if you're in a tough conversation, a difficult conversation, if there's some conflict, you disagree with each other or you're arguing about something. One of the things that happens is that when we are in a conflict conversation, there's a little part of our brain that becomes suspicious. And what it's suspicious of is that the other person isn't actually listening, but is rather just merely waiting their turn to speak. And so in order to make a conversation better, oftentimes we have to prove that we're listening to the other person. And the way that we prove is not what we do while they're speaking, it's how we respond after they finish speaking. And there's something that they teach at Stanford and Harvard and a bunch of other schools that's known as looping for understanding, which is a technique for this. And in looping understanding, there's three steps. The first step is ask a question, preferably a deep question. The second step is try and repeat back in your own words what you just heard that person say. Show them that you're paying attention. Show them that you're processing it. And then step number three, and this is the one we usually forget, ask if you got it right. And the reason why this is so powerful is because what we've done is we've proven that we're trying to understand the other person, that we want to hear them. And there's something hardwired into our brains that when we know that someone is listening to us, we become more likely to listen back to them. In fact, there's another story in the book about this experiment that was done where they brought together gun control activists and gun rights advocates to see if they could have just civil conversations with each other. And they taught them this technique, looping for understanding, and it transformed how these people were talking to each other. And it didn't mean that they walked away from the conversation agreeing with each other. It didn't mean that suddenly they found that they didn't feel differently on the topic of guns. But when they knew that they wanted to understand each other, it made everything so much easier. And oftentimes in a difficult conversation, that's what we're trying to do. We know that we have to have this conversation and we just want to make it a little bit easier to have.
I know from personal experience that this is incredibly important at work. I have a colleague who didn't go to Harvard or Stanford, but he did get an MBA at NYU, and maybe this is where he learned it. But he routinely will say, I'm going to mirror back what you just said to me. And then we'll routinely say, did I get that right? And it has, I mean, especially when we're talking to our clients and with the people that we're trying to move a process along with, it's incredibly effective. People really respond well to it.
Absolutely. And I think it's because it's at work or with clients, you're exactly right. If you're talking to a client, there's part of their brain that wonders, is this person just trying to sell me something, right? Are they really paying attention to what I'm saying? Or are they just waiting to go into their sales pitch? And the more that we prove, no, I'm listening to you. I'm processing what you're saying. The more that at work, when we have conflict as part of work, sometimes we disagree about budgets. We disagree about resource use. We disagree about strategy. And being able to say to someone, listen, I might see this differently, but I really want to understand how you see it. Like, I want to walk away from this conversation really understanding, at least for my own benefit, why you think what you think. And I want you to understand what I think. That changes a conversation significantly because now, instead of trying to beat each other, instead of trying to convince each other, I'm right, you're wrong, I'm smart, you're dumb, what we're really doing is we're just saying, I want to understand you and I want you to understand me. And that doesn't mean we have to agree with each other. But it does mean that it's easier to understand why we're disagreeing and to figure out the places where we do agree.
There are a couple of specific things in the book that I did want to dig into further. But before I do that, we are going to take a very quick break. Let's talk retirement, shall we? Did you know that women are more likely to outlive our retirement savings than men are? That's why having consistent income, a paycheck for life, in addition to Social Security, can be a real game changer. That's where annuities come in. If you're not familiar with annuities, the concept is essentially that you take a chunk of money and turn it into a paycheck that you can start drawing on when you want to, next year or next decade. The Parity Flex multi-year guaranteed annuity available from Gainbridge offers an impressive 5.95% APY long-term, but it also offers flexible withdrawals for unexpected expenses. The Parity Flex multi-year guaranteed annuity can be an important part of your financial future as you work to build a retirement you love. Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Please visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for important information. This is a paid endorsement. We're back. I'm talking with Charles Duhigg, author of the new book, Super Communicators. Chapter 2 of the book is titled, Every Conversation is a Negotiation. Can you talk about that? Because sometimes I think the word negotiation has a bit of a negative connotation to it. And specifically, you talk about interest-based bargaining and why the best negotiations don't have one clear winner.
Well, so you're exactly right. When we say negotiation, most people think of a situation where we're fighting over something. And if I win, you lose, or vice versa. But there's another kind of negotiation, what psychologists refer to as a quiet negotiation, where the goal is not to try and argue with each other. The goal is not to fight over something limited. The goal of that negotiation is actually to understand what everyone wants from this discussion or wants from this interaction. And you're exactly right. There's this thing called interest-based negotiation. If you talk to people who don't negotiate frequently, they'll tell you that negotiations is about winning. But if you talk to professional negotiators, if you talk to people who do this for a living, what they'll say is, no, that's totally wrong. The goal of a negotiation is not to figure out who gets the bigger slice of the pie and to fight over my slice should be bigger than your slice. The goal of a negotiation is to figure out how to make the pie itself larger so that we all walk away with bigger slices than we imagined we would. You see this all the time in negotiations where people say the most important thing is creativity. It's coming up with new solutions that nobody thought of before. But in order to do that, you have to engage in this quiet negotiation to figure out, what does this other person really want? Right? They keep on talking about wages, but are wages the most important thing? Or is it actually wages and time off of the job that's in a workplace setting? Or if I'm talking to my spouse, Liz might be talking about that she really wants a vacation that's restful. But when I start asking questions about it, when I'm trying to figure out what she actually wants, what I learn is she wants a restful vacation, but she also wants to go someplace exciting and exotic. And so once we know more about what everyone wants, once we've had that quiet negotiation to determine that, that's when we can make the pie bigger together.
Take that example and let's talk specifically about wages, because sometimes what people really want is more money.
Yeah.
How do you, if you are the person who's asking, if you're the person who is trying to get an increase in salary, we get these questions all the time. I mean, what is the best communication practice there?
Absolutely. How do we have that conversation where we're asking for a raise? So the first thing to determine is, do we want to have a conversation? And if we want to have a conversation, that means a back and forth. Because most people say, or many people say, I want to have a conversation. And what they actually mean is, I want to walk in and I want to tell my boss that I deserve a higher wage and I want my boss to say yes. That's not actually a conversation. That's a monologue. That's a demand. And sometimes that works. Sometimes we can walk in and we say, I want a higher wage. And they say, okay, you've earned it. But most of the time, what we really should have is a conversation, because they're not predisposed to say yes right away. And a conversation means we are trying to understand how they see the world as much as we're sharing how we see the world. So that conversation should start by asking someone a question, asking your boss a question, sitting down and saying, listen, I've been here for 3 years now and I haven't gotten a raise. I'm wondering from your perspective, what do you think would be fair? What do you think would justify paying me a higher wage? What are you looking for in order to do this? Now, all of a sudden, we're cooperating together, right? We're figuring out the criteria for getting a higher wage. And they might say, well, I see that you've really improved on communication, or you've really improved with your expense accounts. And I think you're right, that deserves a raise. Or they could say, look, we're not exactly where we need to be on productivity, but here's the goal I'm looking for. And if we hit that in 6 months, then I think absolutely you deserve a raise. And then we can say, thank you for sharing that. This is what I hear you saying. Tell me if I'm getting it right. From my perspective, I see things a little bit differently. I think that we have seen a lot of increases in my productivity, and I hear what you're saying, and it's going to continue to get better. But I think we should reward the distance I've already come. Now we're having a conversation. Now we're going back and forth, and we're trying to understand each other. And this is such an easier conversation to have, because the goal of a conversation is not to convince you that I'm right and you're wrong. It's not to convince you that I'm smart and or that you should like me more or that you should agree with me. The goal of a conversation is just to understand each other, for me to understand what you're saying, and then to speak in a way that you can understand me. And when we understand each other, then suddenly we start to see these opportunities for that cooperative negotiation. We start to see these opportunities for us to work together as opposed to work against each other to try and create a better future. Because the truth of the matter is, you as my boss, you want a happy employee. And I, as your worker, I want to earn what I think I'm worth. And that doesn't mean that having that conversation that we're both going to walk away from it feeling like the other person is exactly right, feeling like we agree on everything, but we will be closer to agreement because we've tried to understand each other.
Yeah, I think asking a question like that at the very beginning is, it does so much in the way that it changes the mindset of the boss, right? I'm sort of envisioning myself because I get asked for raises from the people on my team, and I don't know that I've been asked a question like this.
It's really welcoming. Now the other thing is that because these conversations can be tense, because we know that there's a lot of anxiety involved, and one of the things that we've found is that when we're going to have a hard conversation, when we know that it's going to be a little bit awkward, sometimes just acknowledging at the start that it's going to be awkward makes a big difference. And the way to do this is to say something like, look, I want to talk about this thing with you, and I'm a little worried about talking about money because I'm just worried it might be a little bit awkward. And if I say the wrong thing, I apologize in advance, because sometimes the trip from my brain to my lips, the things get screwed up. I hope you'll forgive me. And I promise I will forgive you if you say something that's not exactly what you mean. With that being said, let me ask you a question. That act of acknowledging that this is an awkward conversation, acknowledging discomfort, acknowledging that I might make mistakes and you might make mistakes and we're agreeing to forgive each other in advance, that lessens a lot of that anxiety. And now the conversation's easier, right?
Yeah.
Because now I feel like I can think aloud without it having a negative consequence for me. And that's really important.
So you're talking essentially about vulnerability. I want to layer on gender. You cite a study in the book, and it found that when men express anger or impatience at work, it is commonly seen as a sign of self-confidence. It's good leadership. And when men cry at work, it's a sign that they care. But when women show emotion at work, when they show anger or when they show sadness, there are both social and economic penalties. And just for my listeners to know, I am a woman who has cried at work. So if you are a woman who has cried at work, you do not have to be ashamed of that here. No judging. But how do we deal with this as women? And how do we show vulnerability without being penalized?
No, there are these unfair double standards, right? And anyone should be able to cry at work. And we're hopefully moving towards a world that's a more perfect union where people are judged more equally. But until we get there, we have to deal with the realities of today. And you're exactly right that there are some forms of communication that from men are accepted and from women aren't. And so how do we deal with that? How do we think about that? Well, what's interesting is that one of the things that we found is in conversations where things like gender become an issue or race or politics or background, oftentimes if we focus on just one identity, it can be very either destabilizing and sometimes toxic, right? If I say, Jean, you're the woman in this workplace, so I'm just wondering, how do you see this topic? What do you think we should be doing about wages? That doesn't really seem fair because you're not just a woman. You're also a fellow manager. You're maybe an accountant. You're a sister. You're a mentor to young employees, both male and female. By saying, you're the woman, tell me what you think, I'm pushing you into a corner. I'm pushing you into a stereotype. And the more that we get beyond those stereotypes and we say, Actually, let's welcome all of the identities to the table here. Jean, I'm wondering, as a woman, you probably see this question one way, but as a fellow manager, you might see it a different way. And as someone who's a mentor to younger employees, that might give you a third perspective on it. How do you see this issue? Tell me about that. All of a sudden, what I'm doing there, I'm not ignoring our differences. I'm not discounting them. In fact, I'm acknowledging that we might see things differently. But by inviting all of your identities to the conversation, I'm making it easier for you to tell me what you think, and I'm welcoming you to that discussion. And that feels really good and important. And so I wish that there was a magic wand where I could say, here's how you express vulnerability at work, and it's going to work every single time. And the truth is, until we become a more equitable society, which hopefully we will, there is no magic wand. But the closest we can get to it is to say, when you're at work and the more you remind people of your full self, that you're not just one thing, you're not even just two things, you're dozens of different people, sort of all in this one wonderful container. The more that we remind people of that, the more that we invite other people to share those different perspectives, and we invite their multitudes to the conversation, that's how we can allow vulnerability to flourish without it having penalties.
So if my manager addresses me as the woman in the conversation or the woman in the negotiation, essentially what I hear you saying is that it's okay to say, well, yes, I am absolutely a woman in this conversation, but I'm also X, Y, and Z. And let me answer you from these perspectives.
And to even push it a little bit farther. And once you do that, to say, look, I'm wondering for you, manager, you're male, but I know you're also a person of color. And I know that you're someone who is taking care of your kids. Often you're the primary caregiver. Like, you probably see this from a lot of different perspectives. Tell me how you think about it. The goal here is, because we're so worried about differences, because there's so much anxiety about mentioning our differences, mm-hmm. we often pretend they don't exist. But the key to a social conversation and to having an open conversation and a welcoming conversation is to acknowledge that we're all different from each other. I mean, the fact that I'm a man and you're a woman is a difference, but there's so many other differences and so many other similarities that we have, and we want to connect with each other. And the more that we remind ourselves and others that there's a multitude of identities that we all possess that are important to all of us, that's when we find ways to connect. Because the truth of the matter is, in this age we're living in, with politics being so polarizing, the truth of the matter is, I want to get along with my neighbor. Like, the lawn sign that he has in front of his house for a political candidate, that's like 1% of who he is. And if his lawn sign is different from my lawn sign, that shouldn't define our entire relationship. It should be that we both care about our kids going to the same school together. We care about the pothole that the city hasn't fixed in front of our houses. We have so much more in common, but in order to find ways to connect with each other, we have to acknowledge our differences and we have to acknowledge our similarities.
We started this conversation talking about how you got into it and how you were looking to communicate better with your wife. After you did all the research and the writing, what's the one thing that you are taking away that's making your life better?
The final chapter in the book is about this study that's still ongoing at Harvard, called the Harvard Study of Adult Development. For almost 100 years now, researchers at Harvard have been following around thousands of people, trying to figure out what makes people healthier and happier as they get older. And they had a bunch of theories about this. And basically, they found the only real predictor of health and happiness at age 65, as well as success, however you happen to define that, the only predictor of being healthier and happier at age 65 is having at least a handful of close relationships at age 45, which of course means that you probably started developing those before you were 45. And the way that we get closer to others, the way that we form those connections, is often through conversation, right? And it doesn't have to be conversation you have every day or every week or every month. I have a great friend who lives very far away, and I probably talk to them every 6 or 8 months. But when I do talk to them, I set aside an hour and a half so that we can really catch up with each other. So the thing that I've really carried away from doing this reporting is investing in those connections, investing in those conversations, working to, even though it can be awkward, even though it can be time consuming, even though it can be a little bit hard, working to connect with people who matter to you, that pays huge dividends, not only today, but later in life. And it's easy to prioritize work and it's easy to prioritize our salary. But the truth of the matter is, when we prioritize our relationships, it's the thing that pays off over the long term.
I love it. The book is Super Communicators. Charles, if our listeners want more from you, where would you send them?
Absolutely. You can find Super Communicators in any bookstore near you, Amazon or your local bookstore, which is wonderful. And my website is charlesduhigg.com. Or if you Google Super Communicators or The Power of Habit, you'll find me. And there's information on there how to get in contact with me.
Amazing. Thanks so much for doing this. This was fun for me.
Thank you so much. It was for me too.
Before we dive into our mailbag, a very quick word from our sponsors. Here's one of my money rules. If you can't afford to replace it, insure it. If you can afford to replace it, don't. This rule applies for pretty much all kinds of insurance, and you'll make the right decision on life insurance if you think about it as income insurance. If there are people who depend on your income and they wouldn't be able to replace it without you, buy the life insurance. The good news is life insurance is hugely affordable, but it's one of those things that definitely makes sense to shop around for. The differences can be great. Start by getting a free quote from SelectQuote. SelectQuote has helped people save 50% or more by shopping highly rated insurance carriers for them. In fact, they recently found a 40-year-old woman a $500,000 policy for only $16 a month. They do the legwork and the research for you. Whether you need a $500,000 policy or a $5 million one, their licensed insurance agents can help you find the right policy for you, for your family, and for your budget. If you have people who depend on your income, take a couple minutes today to get your quote. Quotes are completely free and quick to calculate. Go to selectquote.com. That is selectquote.com. Details on the sample rate at selectquote.com. Hey, you guys, it's Jean. I want to tell you about another podcast I think you'll love because I love it. Freakonomics Radio. Every week, host and best-selling author Stephen Dubner dives into the hidden side of business and economics and so much more. He interviews CEOs, historians, even Nobel laureates to explore all kinds of topics like whether AI has a sense of humor and whether two CEOs are better than one. If you are curious like me and just looking to better understand the world around you, you will find it on Freakonomics Radio. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. We are back for Mailbag. My daughter, Julia Chatsky, is joining us to help dive into our questions. Hey, Jules.
Hello. How's it going?
It's going well. I love talking to Charles. I got to know him pretty well when his first book came out, which was about the power of building strong habits. And what he wrote just made so much sense to me in terms of incorporating these better behaviors into our lives, into my life, that I reached out to him and we started a conversation and we've been friends ever since. So a pleasure to talk to him and to talk about his new book. But I also know that we've got listeners who want us to dig in for them. And I took a long time with that interview. So I want to make sure that we have enough time for this.
All right. Well, let's get into it. Our first question comes to us from Mary Catherine. She writes, "Hi, Jean and Julia. A friend just told me about a high-interest savings account. I have about $5,000 that right now I can spare and could commit to something other than my regular savings account. However, I can't give up access to it for any period of time just in case I need it. Are high-interest savings accounts legit? What's in it for the bank? Are there any that you recommend? They just seem too good to be true. Thank you."
I love this question, and I love it particularly right now because, frankly, I think that anybody who has a lot of money sitting in a regular savings account where you're earning, on average, less than 0.5% interest is just missing out, because if you moved your money to a high interest rate savings account, you could earn 4% interest or 5% interest. And just to do the math on the $5,000, if you put $5,000 into a high interest rate savings account
over the course of a year, you're going to earn $250. If you leave it in a regular savings account, you're going to earn about $25. Like, that is just a huge difference when it comes to real money. And as your savings grow, you earn significantly more. Plus, some of these high interest rate savings accounts right now are offering bonuses for opening accounts. So, are they legit? Yes, they're legit. The fact that these banks don't have big brick and mortar presences, they're not typically the banks that you're going to see on the corner of every city, allows them to pay you more in interest because they're not paying out all this money to support their own cost of doing business. These are mostly going to be banks that do business on the internet, but that doesn't mean they're not legitimate. They have the same FDIC protection that your big banks have, which means if something were to happen to the bank, you are guaranteed for deposits of up to $250,000 per depositor. The hitch is the access, and that is sort of what you're talking about here. Most of these high interest rate savings accounts don't come with ATM cards. And so it's not like if you need access to the money, you can just walk to the nearest bank or drive to the nearest bank, put your ATM card in and take it out. Doesn't work that way. You have to transfer the money back from your high interest rate savings account to your regular checking account, and then you can pull it out. Takes about a day. So if you are okay with that kind of access, the fact that maybe you can't get it in an hour, but you can get it in 24 hours or 48 hours, then I think a high interest rate savings account is a great place for the money. And whether there are any that I recommend, the interest rates on these change all the time. And so I would go to a website like bankrate.com, Google high interest rate savings accounts. They'll give you a list of the ones that are paying the most money at any given point in time. And that's where you should put your money. Sound good?
Well, so you know how you're saying like they're not going to be the big banks that you're used to and like to go on whatever website you just said to check them out. But are there red flags that you should look out for, like when you're vetting them or considering names that you don't really know? Like, what are the things that are like, okay, don't go with this one then?
So there are red flags right now, but their red flags are not necessarily for new depositors. They're for people who've had money in these high rate savings accounts for years. If you go to Bankrate and they are promising you a particular interest rate for a particular account at, say, Citizens Access, right? I have a high interest rate savings account. It's at Citizens. You're going to get that interest rate. But there's been a series of stories in the Wall Street Journal lately about how some of these banks are playing a little fast and loose with previous accounts held by depositors. Capital One, for example, has come under recent fire because they have a rate for new depositors that's in the high 4% range. But on some of their older savings accounts, they're paying a much lower rate of interest. And the names of these savings accounts sound suspiciously similar. And so I would say the red flag is not for Mary Catherine, who's thinking about putting her $5,000 in, but for anybody who's listening who has a long existing high interest rate savings account, just take a look at your most recent statement and make sure that you are getting a high rate of interest. And if you're not, pick up the phone, call your bank and ask them why.
Got it. That makes sense.
Okay, great. Let's do the next one.
Our next question comes to us from Angela. She writes, "Hi, Gene and team. I absolutely love the newsletter, and I am so excited to learn from every new piece you post. Here's my situation and question. I left a company 4 years ago that had Cadillac insurance. While they do allow me to continue to take advantage of the amazing insurance through retirement, the rates have increased by 60% since I moved out of state. To top it off, I moved to an area where healthcare services aren't as robust as my former location. I'm currently paying $2,400 a month for my wife and I to have medical, dental, and vision. I know I could save a lot by going into the marketplace, but I'm scared to lose my retiree insurance plan as I know I won't be able to rejoin if the marketplace doesn't pan out. Is the money saved by moving away from a premium insurance package worth the gamble? Thank you in advance for your thoughts, Angela. Can I just ask a first question?
Yeah.
What is Cadillac insurance?
A Cadillac anything is, when I was growing up, a Cadillac was like the best car you could get. A Cadillac was like an amazing car, and you had to have a lot of money to afford a Cadillac. And so Cadillac became the term for top-notch. So a Cadillac insurance plan is a top-notch insurance plan. And that's what she is saying. But it is a very good question. And sometimes we forget that we don't use the same terms that we used to use. Angela, I would definitely shop it around. And I would shop it around for a couple of reasons. First of all, $2,400 a month is a huge amount of money to be paying for medical insurance, even for two people. So I don't know where you live, but I took a quick look at what Silver plans. And when you go and you shop on the healthcare exchanges that were established after the passage of the Affordable Care Act, there are state marketplaces. And you can buy a silver plan, which is sort of a mid-tier plan. There's bronze, there's silver, and there's gold. You can buy a silver plan for an average of anywhere from about $350 in states like Maryland and Minnesota to over $600 in places like Connecticut and more than $800 in West Virginia and Vermont. West Virginia and Vermont have pretty much the highest prices on these plans in the country. But even if you happen to live there at that rate, that's still a substantial savings for you at $1,600 for you and your wife compared to the $2,400 that you are paying right now. The other consideration for the two of you is what you're actually able to access as far as healthcare because of where you're living right now. You want to make sure that you've got really good hospitalization in case anything happens. You want to make sure that your out-of-pocket is capped at a reasonable rate per year, and you want to make sure that you can access the doctors that you want to see and take the medicines that you need to take. By and large, you should be able to accomplish all of those things with a silver plan. I think you're paying a lot of money for things that you are no longer able to use because of that move out of state where healthcare services are not robust. So here's how I would go about it. I'd shop around first. I'd apply for the new plan first, and then I'd get rid of the old plan so that you are convinced that you are able to get a plan that will serve your needs. When you look at these new plans on the exchange, look for very specific things. Look for the drugs that you take in the formulary. Look for the doctors that you want to see in plan or at least accessible at a reasonable rate. And look at the healthcare that you used over the recent year and make sure that you would have been able to do all of those things on this new plan. At that point, I think that you are going to be good to go. Make sense, Jules?
Totally.
That's good. If you've got any other money-related questions, we would love to hear from you. Send them our way by emailing us at mailbag@hermoney.com. Thank you so much for joining me today on Her Money. If you like what you hear, please subscribe to our show at Apple Podcasts. Leave us a review. We love hearing what you think. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Edelman Financial Engines. Her Money is produced by Haley Pascalides. This show is mixed and mastered by CDM Sound Studios. Our music is provided by Video Helper, and our show comes to you through Megaphone. Check out our new podcast, How She Does It with Karen Feinerman, for intimate cocktail party style conversations with today's most talented female leaders. This podcast is also part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. You can find us and other shows like us at airwavemedia.com. Thanks for joining us, and we'll talk soon.